supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. There is late breaking news this afternoon regarding the 2015 deadly derailment of Amtrak train 188 in Philadelphia. Bobby Allen joins me now with the latest. Bobby, a pretty busy day.
Yeah, indeed, Dave. So Tuesday, the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office determined that Brandon Bastian, who was the engineer of Amtrak 188, that's the train that derailed May 2015, killed eight and left more than 200 injured, that he would not be charged because there was insufficient evidence to bring charges. And today, there was a private criminal complaint filed by the family of one of the victims, of someone who died in the Amtrak train. And in a very surprise development, a judge approved that private criminal complaint, and it's now being sent and examined by the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office.
Now, to recall, this was a train that accelerated to 106 miles an hour on a 50-mile-an-hour curve. And again, the district attorney's office ruled that Bastian did not act with something called, quote, conscious disregard. Apparently, the judge disagreed.
Yeah. So, when the DA's office took a look at all of the evidence, they said it does appear as if Brandon Bastian caused this derailment. But to cause the derailment and to be able to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that he consciously avoided the chance of risk and had intent is a different thing. So they said there's just not sufficient evidence to bring these charges. The National Transportation Safety Board, when they did their big study of this, they were also even-handed and said, you know, Bastian was the reason this derailed, but wouldn't, you know, place it squarely on him, wouldn't say that, you know, this should trigger criminal charges. So the judge approving this and the AG now looking it over means that there may be charges against Bastian. That said, a veteran criminal defense attorney I just talked to said if the AG looks at this, if AG Josh Shapiro's folks look at this and say that, no, there shouldn't be any charges, it's pretty much dead in the water. So it's all in the AG's hands right now.
Now, to what extent was this foreseen and is it unprecedented?
So a private criminal complaint can be filed, Dave, by you or I or anyone. If we think that we are aggrieved in some way, we can walk, fill out the form, and if the DA's office agrees to it, they'll represent us. Now, to file a private criminal complaint after the DA's office determines that they can't bring the case, it's unlikely that they're going to change their mind. And they didn't change their mind here. What they did after the private criminal complaint was filed is say, hey, we already looked at this. Not enough evidence. We're sending it to the AG. But what gives it extra umph here is that a municipal judge, the president of the municipal court in Davidson County, agreed that the AG's office should take a look. So the AG's office right now is under an order from a municipal court judge to take a look at this and to strongly consider, you know, whether charges should be filed. And those charges are reckless endangerment and manslaughter, and they're punishable up to 5 years in prison.
Again, the derailment took place in May 2015. Any sense of the timetable moving forward?
So the attorneys that were just at the press conference said that Brandon Bastian is out of the state right now. They didn't say exactly where. If the attorney general decides to proceed and press charges, there would be a warrant out for his arrest and the criminal case would go forward. If the AG's office agrees with the DA and says, nope, not enough here, it's over. So we should be hearing shortly, probably within the next couple days or weeks, as to what the AG is going to do. And I'll be back with updates.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks.
WHYY's Bobby Allen reporting. Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams' indictment on corruption charges and decision not to seek re-election has turned this normally sleepy election year in Philadelphia upside down. Seven Democrats are going all out for the party's nomination to replace Williams in a primary election that's next Tuesday, just 5 days from now. Joining me to take stock of the race is WHYY's Dave Davies. And Dave, for a long time you were telling us that there is no frontrunner, though Larry Krasner, the attorney representing protesters, seems to be making some noise.
Yeah, two big endorsements for Krasner just today, Dave. You know, he came into the race pretty late. He's a darling of the progressive community, which is a start, but not enough to win citywide races. He has, however, built a coalition, got some labor endorsements, and then the backing of some very prominent African-American leaders from Northwest Philadelphia who are known for turning out votes. They helped Mayor Kenney back when he ran for mayor. And today, Krasner got the endorsement of the leading black clergy group in the Philadelphia area, and then the endorsement of State Senator Vincent Hughes, a veteran African-American leader in West Philadelphia. He held a news conference today.
It's not a knock on anyone else. 30 years of fighting for civil rights and fighting for justice cannot be ignored. You just can't kick that to the curb.
So that was Hughes explaining why he's for Krasner. It's still a race, but Krasner clearly has some momentum.
Now, you're mentioning African-American support for Krasner. What about the one African-American candidate in the race?
Yeah, that's Tariq El-Shabazz. Got into the race even later than Krasner, has raised very little money, and his campaign has been all but invisible to the media, Dave. He seems to be targeting African-American voters. Last Saturday, he got the endorsement of some city council members in West Philadelphia. And here in this little bit of his speech, you can hear he's taking a shot at Krasner, who, as we know, is a civil rights attorney and has been getting African-American support. El-Shabazz said this is not a race for president of the ACLU.
It's not an election for us to determine who is best suited to help put forth First Amendment freedom of speech rights. This is an election to decide how we can keep Philadelphia safe.
All right, so he's clearly taking a shot at Krasner. That's his message. He doesn't have a lot of money to promote it, but political pros do point out he has a name that says he's probably a black candidate, and that could attract some votes.
Now let's look at the other five candidates. Who's attacking who?
Well, it's interesting. Here's a new ad run by Michael Untermyer, the former prosecutor who's now a real estate developer.
Who's the real Democrat running for district attorney? Joe Kahn worked for George Bush's Justice Department. Kahn has been.
That ad is aimed at Joe Kahn, the former prosecutor who has raised some money and gotten Ed Rendell's endorsement. Untermyer's charges against Kahn are honestly pretty thin. He says he worked for Bush's Justice Department. He happened to be a federal prosecutor when Bush was president. But what this really is retaliation for Kahn attacking Untermyer a couple of weeks ago because he noted that Untermyer is a guy who's run for office twice as a Republican, saying you're not a real Democrat. So this is kind of a fight about who's the real Democrat, and it really underscores the importance of money in this race, Dave. Untermyer is wealthy. He's put close to $1 million of his own into this campaign, has aired a ton of TV ads, so Kahn felt he had to try and take him down, and that's why we're seeing this scrap about who's the biggest Democrat. And we can't talk about money in the race without mentioning the $1.4 million that the billionaire George Soros spent on an independent campaign to help Larry Krasner, and that's another reason for his surge.
So, Dave, money, media, endorsements. What about the Democratic Street Organization, the party's 69 ward leaders? Do they have a say?
Oh, they sure do, especially in a low turnout race like this one is expected to be. You know, the way it works, Dave, is a ward leader picks a candidate, and then the neighborhood committee people in that ward recommend the candidate to their neighbors and give them, you know, ballots on the way into the polls, and that can sway enough votes to matter. Now, those decisions of the ward leaders are driven by a lot of things, deals, political alliances, and grudges, and they often aren't known until election day. Max Marin, a reporter for the Philadelphia Weekly, decided to try and figure out what's going on. He says he made more than 200 phone calls to figure out which ward leaders are for whom.
And with that, what did he figure out?
He found it's pretty open, Dave. You know, there are three candidates we haven't even mentioned yet, Teresa Cardenai, Jack O'Neill, and Rich Negron. And what this survey found was nobody has anything close to a majority of ward leaders. Everybody has a few. And so that can make this race pretty unpredictable. And it does bring us back to where we started, because money matters in persuading ward leaders to be for you. And with all of this national money helping Larry Krasner with an ad campaign and a field operation, he can devote some of the $100,000 or so he has to incentivizing, let us say, ward leaders to give him support. And he's doing that.
Turnout's pretty paltry on a primary election day, but everything else being equal, who might be most advantaged if that turnout is relatively high?
I guess you'd have to say the candidates who've had the big media presence, and that would be Michael Untermyer and Larry Krasner. They've had a lot of ads on the air. Joe Kahn has also had some, but Untermyer and Krasner have had the most.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies on Newsworks Tonight. And when the polls close Tuesday night at 8, stay with WHYY for election coverage and analysis through the evening. By the year 2050, a projected 16 million Americans will be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. 83% of them are cared for by family members. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports that universities in New Jersey and the company Otsuka are launching a one-year certificate program where students can learn how to help Alzheimer's patients get better care.
It's a collaboration between Rowan University, Rutgers Camden, Otsuka, and Camden County College. They're launching a certificate program at the county college where students can become journey coordinators for patients with Alzheimer's.
We think this has to be a mature, skilled person that can stay with the family through the entire journey, hence the name Journey Coordinator.
That's Chris Calori, the CEO at Rowan University Rutgers Camden Board of Governors. He says they're thinking about this as a paradigm shift, and that right now, if someone wants to hire someone to fulfill this role, there simply aren't candidates with the right training. Calori says this isn't about waiting for a call to come from the family. The Journey Coordinator will check in regularly and will proactively engage in every facet of the family's life. For Lisa Winstell, Chief Operating Officer for Caregiver Action Network, that's great news. She says caregivers face increased risk of depression and chronic disease, and they struggle with uncertainty over how quickly their loved one's symptoms could progress.
One of the things that I think is really going to come out of this program is we're going to have a reduction of that stress of the unknown, because they're going to have that journey coordinator for them. And also that journey coordinator is probably going to help them remember to take care of themselves.
In the first year, the program hopes to recruit 20 students. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
For better and worse, the opioid epidemic has become big business. Private equity companies have been buying up, bundling together, and reselling treatment centers around the country. To understand what big money is doing to recovery services now, WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that it helps to look back to the 1980s.
In the 80s, shoulder pads were in. The USSR was still a thing, and the baddest drug wasn't opioids.
See this cute little vial here? It's crack, rock cocaine. The most
addiction to cocaine and its cheaper derivative, crack, was so common, Clint Eastwood lent his husky voice to a public service announcement.
You think it's the glamour drug of the 80s? Well, that's the point of this friendly little reminder. It can kill you, and if you've got to die for something.
But celebrities weren't only talking tough. They were also coming clean with their own struggles with addiction. In 1982, former First Lady Betty Ford's admission that she'd abused prescription pills and alcohol showed not even the first family is immune. With that building awareness, it makes sense that addiction treatment had a moment too.
The 80s really became a time when celebrities, athletes would kind of jumped on this bandwagon that it was actually kind of cool to be in recovery.
Doug Tiemann is the CEO of Care and Treatment Centers, a large nonprofit treatment provider. He says demand for services, lifting stigma, and relatively loose insurance rules triggered a flood of investment from Wall Street into recovery services in the late 1980s. As someone who's been in the treatment business for a long time, Tiemann has hit the lecture circuit to warn investors not to repeat the mistakes of the past. Otherwise, you risk losing the public's compassion for people in recovery.
You know, I mean, we had people go to jail in the 90s for insurance fraud, Medicaid fraud.
That fraud led to changes in insurance coverage that made investing in treatment less profitable. But trying to control spending wound up hurting clients, too, who lost access to subsidized care. Fast forward to 2008. Healthcare law started changing to make treatment more available. Once again, that set the stage for an investment frenzy, pitched even higher than before. Marvin Ventrell heads up the Trade Association for Treatment Centers.
I don't think that the public and the investment industry has seen this kind of opportunity to produce income from treating addiction ever before.
Bain, the investment firm, not the Batman villain, bought the largest addiction service provider in the country and made it even bigger. Then it turned around and sold it to another company, Acadia Health, in 2014. The selling price? $1.2 billion. All that money sloshing around has a way of magnifying the industry's strengths and weaknesses. It's also bringing new players onto the scene. Recently, I went to check out a place called The Lighthouse near the Jersey Shore. It's owned by a new company, Recovery Centers of America.
Come on in.
Sunlight streams in through big windows in the common areas, and the whole place is decorated like a tasteful beach house in pale blues and white. Denny Carice heads up treatment for the company and says they want to make recovery inviting.
We offer yoga twice a week for every patient in small groups, the exercise classes as well twice a week. We also have meditation.
Recovery Centers of America is the brainchild of real estate mogul Brian O'Neill, who's based in suburban Philadelphia. He's backed by more than $330 million from a hedge fund. Director of Operations Michael DeRozier says the center has tweaked the normal 30 or 90 day residential treatment model to reflect what insurance will actually pay for.
The average stay here is 12 days between detox and residential.
Many addiction experts believe longer is better when it comes to treatment. So DeRozier says the company feeds its clients into outpatient services to try to keep them on the road to recovery. Recovery Centers of America, like other companies with big backers, can also throw a lot of money at marketing. To compete, some providers are playing dirty to get clients.
Oh, my God. The things you find out. Because, you know, you're desperate. At the time, you just want to get them help.
Alice LaRocca's son, Shane, has been in and out of treatment for opioid addiction for the last 10 years. I went to go talk to the family in their home, a cozy one-story house in Sicklerville, New Jersey, about 20 minutes from Philadelphia. Alice says she's had to learn the hard way how to pick a good provider.
One place looked like he was doing great, and 3 weeks later, I find out that he's in a dark room using, and they're charging my insurance company.
She shows me a bill. $1,200 a pop for urine tests that Shane was faking at a facility in Deerfield Beach, Florida. By the end of his stay, Shane says it was obvious he was being taken advantage of.
I remember like right before I left there because I relapsed and I told them. And they made sure they got a pee test from me before I left. For what reason? You know what I mean? Like just so they could charge me one last time.
The company was billing his insurance thousands of dollars a week just for pee tests. Overbilling and unnecessary testing are just two items on a menu of unethical techniques that have spread, says Doug Tiemann from Care and Treatment Centers. Another shady thing can happen right when people reach out for help.
So you call, you know, they think they're calling into a treatment center, and then once you're there and they get the prototype of who you are and what kind of insurance you have, they then sell your name to the treatment center that will pay the most for you.
That one is so common, it has a name, patient brokering. This is all happening while the industry as a whole is trying to clean up its image. Attorney generals in Florida and other states are going after patient brokers and drug testing labs. But Tiemann says it's high time the industry learns to police itself. He's even looking into creating a new good business certification for treatment centers so consumers know what they're getting.
Because if we can't police ourselves, the government and insurance companies will police it for us.
And chances are they will squander a precious commodity, compassion for those battling addiction. And at a time where healthcare is in flux and the way addiction is covered could change dramatically once again, that could deliver a massive blow to the treatment industry. I'm Laura Benshoff.
This story was produced for the Pulse's Follow the Money episode, and you can hear the entire show tomorrow morning at 9. This month, the presenting organizations Bauer Bird and the Slott Foundation are mounting a two-prong retrospective of a 20th century composer with a Philadelphia connection. That Which is Fundamental is a concert series and visual exhibit of the life and work of Julius Eastman, who managed to produce a lot in a short life. WHYY's Kimberly Haas offers this preview.
At first glance, it's a classic tale of wasted talent. A piano prodigy with an exclusive conservatory education. And then, dogged by alcohol and drugs, homeless and dead at the age of 50.
There's this story of tragedy that sort of surrounds him.
Dustin Hurt says Julius Eastman's story is complicated. Hurt is director of the presenting organization Bauer Bird in West Philadelphia.
His creative life extended from about 1968 to 1983 or 84, and he actually accomplished quite a lot. He composed about 50 compositions. He was well-regarded as a singer, Grammy-nominated, performed with the New York Philharmonic, toured the world. And I think there's an opportunity to introduce that into the story of this was a person who accomplished a lot.
Julius Eastman came to Philadelphia in the early 1960s to attend the Curtis Institute of Music. After growing up in a working-class black neighborhood, the rarefied atmosphere of Curtis was a tough fit. It wasn't his first encounter with feeling like an outsider. the African-American community in Eastman's hometown of Ithaca, New York, was not friendly to a gay man either. But his talent carried him through. Despite having studied the instrument for only 6 years, he was admitted as a piano major, though ultimately he switched to composition. Speaking over Skype, fellow composer David Borden remembers Eastman as a sort of Renaissance man.
You know, he's a great choreographer, fantastic pianist, a great composer, and a great singer. He could do it all.
Musically, it was a revolutionary time, from free jazz, experiments in rock music, and composers breaking free from the Western classical tradition. Eastman made a mark as a singer, his rich baritone giving the definitive performance of Eight Songs for a Mad King by British composer Peter Maxwell Davies. In his own compositions, he reveled in dramatic juxtapositions, improvisation, and provocative titles and stagings. The challenge was not the making of art, but how to make a living from it. Many composers found security in academia, but Borden says it wasn't a good fit for Eastman.
He could come to your class and be fantastic for an hour, but if you asked him to do that for 5 years of semesters, he just found that so dull.
Eastman gravitated first to Buffalo, New York, an epicenter of modern music at the time, then to New York City's downtown music scene. Without a reliable source of income, he succumbed to the stresses of the city, struggling with alcohol and drugs, and becoming homeless, dying in 1990. For years, it seemed like the story would end there. But recently, there's been a resurgence of interest in Julius Eastman. A 3-disc recording, a book about his life, a video of one of his piano works, and an homage by interdisciplinary artist Jace Clayton, including a performance at the Barnes Foundation last year. And this month, a concert series and visual exhibit are being mounted in Philadelphia by Bowerbird and the Slott Foundation. Dustin Hurt is co-curator and says they wanted to reflect the wide range of Eastman's musical interests.
We took the opportunity to engage with lots of different musicians. So there's musicians that are involved in the concerts. You know, they only do orchestra gigs, and then sitting right next to them is someone that's in the Sun Ra Orchestra. So this is something that the openness of Julius's music really allows.
That openness includes leaving much up to the performers to decide, even which instruments to use.
There's 3 pieces that are actually written for multiples of any instrument, for any number of instruments that are the same. And so we are doing one of them. The piece is called Gay Gorilla, as in like guerrilla warfare, often performed as a piece for 4 pianos, which I'm doing a special version of for 15 electric guitars.
For the companion visual exhibit, co-curator Tiana Nakia McLaughlin arranged photographs, scores, and other Eastman artifacts alongside the work of 10 contemporary artists.
I'm looking at notions of absence, exhaustion, in terms of like just pushing everything to the limits. Also really, really trying to bring in folks who I felt I could talk about in relationship to Eastman's biography as well as some of his works.
All this activity, nearly 30 years after his death, raises the question, why now? As a queer African-American woman, McLaughlin has personal reasons for her interest.
Sometimes when hostile political times where people feel very silenced, they look to people who were kind of pushing it, like how to bring their own personal identities within very conservative spaces, right? And I think Eastman is someone who's pushing it. It's kind of like someone that you kind of want to be.
Dustin Hurt thinks one reason is a change of views about race.
I think something really shifted in the public consciousness, people of color, African-American artists, and how they're being perceived both historically and now. And this fit into a wider context of what was going on with police shootings and the political climate, but also there's a desire in some sense to put it right that I think is a lot different than maybe other times in history.
Julius Eastman, That Which Is Fundamental, runs through May 28th at the Slott Foundation, with concerts on Friday nights at the Rotunda, both in West Philadelphia. Kimberly Haas, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.